Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the brand new episode of Film Stage Show, the official movie review podcast of filmstage.com. And with me today, M.
Woo!
We also have Michael Snydell.
Good morning.
Friday morning to talk about Baby Driver, the newest film by writer-director Edgar Wright. This film stars Ansel Elgort, John Hamm, Kevin Spacey, and Jamie Foxx, amongst others. And that's all we're going to be talking about today. So look forward to that. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can follow us on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Of course, you can podcast.com. Give us a comment and a rating on iTunes by searching for The Film Stage Show. Let us know how we're doing. We love your feedback. And
you just lagged, and it sounded like you literally like remixed what you were saying.
yes, it did. It did.
That's pretty awesome, considering a plot point that is in this movie. So, just gonna leave it in. Gonna let it be a meta.
Obviously intentional.
Yeah, totally. Totally want my voice to fuck up on this podcast. So yeah, we're going to be talking about Baby Driver. Before we do that, let me remind everyone out there that we do have a Patreon going on. So if you would like to help support, go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and sign up to donate as much as $1, or as little as $1 an episode to help us create a better show, a better listening experience, and even new episodes. If we make $50 an episode, we will start doing a classic movie podcast. If you donate, you will be entered into special raffles. So, for instance, this week we're giving away a Criterion Blu-ray of Tampopo that we stole from our editor, Jordan Raup, after breaking into his house and forcing him to eat an entire turkey until he fell asleep. So, good times. Good times all around. So yes, all you have to do is go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/thefilmstageshow, and you can see the great... Also, we are brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. You can get a free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. And the great thing about Mubi is that they only ever have 30 films on at a time. Every day they introduce a new film and you have 30 days to watch. And then after 30 days, that film disappears to be replaced by the film of that day. So you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films. And you know that they're great because they're handpicked by Mubi's curators, which is a phrase that is surprisingly difficult to say. And not only that, but you have a bevy of ways to watch. You can watch mobile, you can watch on your computer, you can watch on their beautiful Roku app. And if you're heading out into the great blue wilderness, and you're not going to have internet connection, but you are going to have a cell phone that can maintain a charge over the course of many days, you can download Mubi movies right to your phone so that you can watch them on the go. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, so you can understand the wonder that is Mubi, all you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage. Again, that is mubi.com/filmstage. All right, gentlemen, are we ready? Are we ready to rev our engines and start zipping through the streets to talk about Baby Driver?
I guess.
On your mark, get set, and go.
So you just starting your day, or did you just get off?
I call, I go, you know.
So what is it you do?
I'm a driver.
Oh, like a chauffeur. Anyone I'd know?
I hope not.
What is your name?
Baby.
Your name's Baby. B-A-B-Y, Baby.
So that is the trailer for Baby Driver. Again, the newest film from writer-director Edgar Wright. This film stars Ansel Elgort as a young man who is conscripted into being a getaway driver for a crime boss played by Kevin Spacey. He ends up striking up a tentative relationship with Lily James, who plays Deborah. And the movie is about him negotiating that, as well as a series of heists with such notable criminals as John Hamm, Isa Gonzalez, John Bernthal.
Flea.
What was that?
Flea.
Flea. And
why are we all giggles today? What is going on with y'all?
I don't know. I'm punchy. Yesterday was my daughter's first birthday.
Oh, okay.
So I'm still
happy belated birthday.
Yeah, it's to your daughter that we're not speaking to.
Yeah, I'll pass it on, Michael.
Thanks.
But also, I just realized that I said noted criminals, and then I just started naming actors. And Jamie Foxx. Whether or not these actors are actually criminals, I can't say. That is for time to tell. But they definitely play ones in this movie. So this is a movie filled with a lot of pop music, car chases, and madness. A very important plot point that I forgot to mention. Baby was in a car accident as a child, and he still has a hum in the drum, as Kevin Spacey says. And so he plays...
Okay, tinnitus. Don't just say hum and a drum. It's not like a universal, you know, hum and the drum.
I'm sorry, but this movie treats it like that. He has tinnitus. He has a constant ringing in his ears. He's got a hum in the drum. And he plays music to drown it out from a series of iPods that he has. But this movie also gets in a vinyl fetishization thing, too, because he also has a shit ton of vinyls at home.
Analog, a lot of analog.
Yeah. He also makes music based on conversations that he records onto cassette tapes. So yeah, Bill, you're right. A lot of analog, not just vinyl. Anyway, so Baby Driver. This has been a passion project of Edgar Wright's for a while. He got it made. Let's see how it is. Bill Graham, we're going to start with you. What were your thoughts... Well, what are your thoughts on Edgar Wright, briefly, and then briefly as well, what were your thoughts on Baby Driver?
On Edgar Wright as a whole, I like him as a filmmaker. I think he's got a very kind of pop aesthetic to him. I was telling my friend Andy after the screening yesterday that Edgar Wright now kind of reminds me a lot of a more fun, a more kind of... lighthearted Tarantino, where he takes a lot of genres and he mashes them together, and he plays homage to a lot of things. He's constantly referencing things. There's a great Monsters, Inc. reference in this film right in the middle of like a very like intense sequence, and it's like he very noticeably homages a lot of things throughout his films. This one in particular has a lot of them. I don't know if it's just because I'm more aware of them or what, but this one definitely has a lot of those. And I find his films to be genuinely charming for the most part. Hot Fuzz, I think, is still a very high watermark for him. It has a careful balance where it's hilarious and also shocking and also a lot of fun, and it's got good action set pieces. He's good with action as well. Scott Pilgrim is still my favorite film from his, and I just feel like he has a intensity and kind of a pace to most of his films that just kind of easily drag you along, and they rarely wear out their welcome. At World's End is a little bit overlong. It's one of his lesser films, but even then, it's still an interesting film, and there's still a lot to like in certain moments of that film. So
I will say it's simply called The World's End. At World's End is one of the pirate sequels.
That's the name of the bar, The World's End.
Yeah.
Interesting. but yeah, this film overall, it's been very, very highly hyped. And it's funny because when it first kind of started to screen, I had heard kind of mixed reactions, and it seems like the hype machine has just built and built and built ever since. I feel like this is a very, very well-made film, but I don't know if I would ever round the corner and start to say I love it. There was something just missing, and I don't know if it's the main character, if it's just Ansel that I'm just not connecting with, because certainly the other characters in this film are charming as hell. I love post Mad Men, John Hamm. He's fantastic. And Jamie Foxx is giving a great performance here. Everybody's kind of doing really, really interesting work. And I think maybe he whiffed on his main character. I'm not sure what it is, but there's something that just feels a little bit off. This film has a lot of ups and downs. The action set pieces, the driving sequences in this film are absolutely fantastic. Like some of the best I've seen in a long time. There is a feeling like that reminds me a lot of Mad Max Fury Road, where I can tell things were actually shot in, you know, on screen. It wasn't some CGI creation and things like that. A lot of it is very clearly done in a practical effect. And it starts to get a little wonky towards the end. And we can go into that in spoilers. But overall, I think the music and the action beats are fantastic. The storyline, the romance at the heart of it is a little kind of hit or miss for me. And then there's the finale that's really going to give a lot of people kind of pause, or they're going to celebrate it. I think there's not going to be a lot of people that are going to be in the middle on the way this film kind of ends. And I'm curious to see how y'all feel about it. I'm curious to see how others feel about it now that I can kind of safely wade into reviews and stuff like that and spoiler discussions. I will say real quick, I want to point out the film was – what I had heard early on was that the action sequences and a lot of the beats and a lot of the moments, because music is constantly used throughout, because that's kind of the main character's viewpoint. And so we're mainly through his perspective. And so we're constantly getting a lot of music. And what I had heard was that a lot of the action beats and things like that were set to the music specifically. Gunshots, things like that were supposed to happen with the beat of the music. The first time through, I was completely oblivious to all of that. I saw it with a friend that had seen it the second time, and he said he started to notice those things on the second watch. So I think it's going to be curious to watch this again and see some of those other aspects kind of shine and kind of take root. So, yeah, I enjoyed it overall, but it's not something that I'm immediately itching to go back to see.
All right, Michael Snydell.
Yeah, so Edgar Wright is someone who I think his first film, Shaun of the Dead, is still the best overall film. But I think that every time it's been interesting that he has honed different aspects. I think he gets better every time up until The World's End, which I thought by far was his worst, because it wasn't able to juggle the tones or the tonal mix that the rest of his films have. As Bill said, like, Tarantino is kind of the easy one to jump to, just because of the way that he collects and reconfigures so many different like archetypes and shot choices and things. But I feel like he's a little bit less slavish than Tarantino, which is not a knock against him, but just something I notice. And the other thing is, I think that Edgar Wright more willingly takes from high and low in the sense of, like, you know, yeah, like, he does, like, he, Edgar Wright will absolutely mention, like, a cult movie, you know, something like Walter Hill's The Driver when talking about this, but he's also, like, a proponent of Bay that you literally see, like, embedded in his movies, like Hot Fuzz. So this Baby Driver is kind of interesting in the sense that it is literally a physical embodiment of what Edgar Wright has been doing in every single film, literally made the plot of the film. Like, he created the thinnest pretenses for all of his loves to be in this movie. And I saw this about a month – or not a month ago. Excuse me. Last week. And getting out of it, I had an absolute blast. This is the most fun I've had in a theater watching a blockbuster. I said on Slack, I don't know if I'd stick with it, but I said my immediate gut reaction was it was the most fun I'd had since Fury Road at a theater. And with some time, I still think it's a pretty incredibly conceived movie. You know, from not only the car chases, which are pitch perfect and just have a real sense of personality and atmosphere. And it's not just about, you know, literally, you know, knowing right when to cut, which Wright has always understood, but just being able to understand scale in every single sequence. Like, this is something that he's almost peerless at today when it comes to, you know, like, to these movie makers who just want to give you that endorphin rush. Mm-hmm. Like Bill, I also think that a huge – I think the third act for this is going to be incredibly divisive. And I got off the train a little bit in the third act because it does make these characters that are more interesting earlier in the film. And you know, I have heard some complaints about this as being thin. I don't necessarily see that. I think that Edgar Wright, like, deploys the right moments with some of these characters, and we can get into that in spoilers, because I really do think it's a little bit unfair to call this thin. And I think Ansel as well is someone who, you know, your mileage is going to vary on him, you know, because he's the epitome of the teeny bopper
mileage.
He's the epitome of the teeny bopper image. Personally, I've seen him in a number of things, including the, you know, John Green Weepy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, that was and yeah, he was kind of smug there. And I think Edgar Wright knows how to use him here to be able to lean into his cutesiness, but then also to continually challenge it. And the last thing I'll say is, like, you were saying this left you a little bit cold. I felt a really strong spiritual connection with this movie, partly because I really don't mean this to sound like this was genuinely unhealthy. I've spent, like, years of my life with headphones in when I should not have them in. And I used that to, like, constantly get away from people. Because I was afraid of, like if I didn't have my headphones, I literally felt like
exposed.
Yeah, I felt exposed and handicapped, and I was, like, terrified that people would, like, you know, come up to me. Yeah, no, seriously.
No, I'm the same way. One day my phone died and I kept the headphones in.
Yep. Oh my god. Yes.
There's no fucking way on earth that I'm about to have to talk to some motherfucker on this train.
So that's super unhealthy, but, like, I definitely felt a spiritual connection that I think some people aren't going to feel. And then the other last thing I want to say is I was familiar with a lot of these songs. I was kind of surprised there weren't a few more deep cuts. Like, if you've heard, you know, even some pretty familiar rap, you've probably heard a lot of these songs sampled. So I got a kick out of hearing certain things, but I do think that people who aren't into music aren't going to get the same thing out of this. And I think, you know, there has been a comparison to things like Girl Talk, with this. And the thing about Girl Talk is that that is very much, you know, that is more obscure songs and the choruses, you know, and that's not really what this is. Like, everything's very rhythmic and it's, you know, edited to a T, but it is also very much like, it's very much made for one type of person. This hits every one of my pleasure centers. And I don't expect that a lot of other people who don't have the this devotion to music, I think they'll probably find it kind of annoying. And so, yeah, I think this is a very good movie. I think, but I also think that if you don't like Edgar Wright, that's not going to change.
Yeah, it's so here's the deal. So first I'll start off with Edgar Wright. I liked Shaun of the Dead. I loved Hot Fuzz. I hated Scott Pilgrim. And I had a lot of tonal and third act problems with The World's End. Now, because I hated Scott Pilgrim so much, people have this idea that I don't like Edgar Wright, which is deeply false. I watch Hot Fuzz like every 4 months because it's fun and I like it. I don't really watch Shaun of the Dead that much because that's a very shaggy movie. Mm-hmm. If you're not in the mood for that very specific movie, it's hard to get into. But it's like, it's a first feature. And it's really good, and like it's still quotable in many ways. So like I don't have a problem.
It's also like genuinely a new take on a zombie movie, which is insane.
So here's the deal. All that being said, I hated this movie. This movie was terrible. It's like if Drive was produced by the Disney Channel and written by one of those guys from the 90s who was trying to rip off Pulp Fiction era Quentin Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
And did it poorly, obviously, because no one in the 90s who was trying to rip off Pulp Fiction era Quentin Tarantino did it well. Now, and this is where it gets crazy, because I feel like I'm going to be with this movie like I was with Scott Pilgrim versus the World, where like I'm going to point out a bunch of very obvious things that are wrong with it, and then people just aren't going to have seen them, or they're not going to care. And so like...
Latter.
So I like, I have a problem. I was really hoping to like this movie. Like, I love A Car Chase as much as The Next Man, and I don't have a problem with pop music. Someone after, I think, Fantastic Fest or wherever it first played said...
South By,
that's it. Said that this was like a musical set to Car Chases, which like made my mouth water. I was like, yeah, that's yeah. good. And I feel like if you were to take like the homagery, which is not a word, of Hot Fuzz, and marry it to the buddy kind of bro shaggy comedy of Shaun of the Dead, you'd have what I was expecting in this movie. And instead, you have a listless lead performance tied to a romance that has all the chemistry of pouring a cup of water into another cup of water. And a series of heists that are populated by cartoon characters that are, like, vaguely racist, I think. Like, we all know that I'm not the guy to come to for, like, pointing out problematic things in movies. I have trouble with that. My white privilege affords me the ability to not really see things like that. And whether that's a good or a bad thing, you know, stands the test of time to know. For sure. Usually it's a bad thing, because I'll love something and then someone will
What
be
is
like,
it a good thing?
Just because, like, I can enjoy things that other people can't. And like,
sure.
I,
yeah. You're oblivious to it, right? Yeah. Yeah.
So I'll love something and then someone
will
say,
Can I pause real quick, Brian? Because I do want to make one thing. This is the second time that Edgar Wright has kind of had to Americanize his sensibility. Do you think that it's partly
that he doesn't get America?
Yeah.
It's possible, sure. But like Hell or High Water was made by a Scottish guy, wasn't it? Like, it's possible for these UK directors to come over here and make a movie that's set in America well. So, like, sure. I don't know if Edgar Wright... And the thing is, I'll say this. Like, I follow Edgar Wright on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And he is, like, talking about how this movie's been in his brain for 22 years, and he's so excited it's finally on the screen. Sure. And, like, he wrote the script 8 years ago. And, like, you know, I know how that is. I have had ideas that it took me a while to write down and, like, really create something with. And so mm-hmm. I feel terrible about shitting on this movie. But I have to, because it's not good and it's not fun. Like, I was deeply bored in this movie. Bill, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I do want to mention, I guess... I don't know how well known it is, but and I'll have to double check myself again here later. But Edgar Wright has more than just like, oh, this was like a passion project and, you know, he's wanted to do it. If I'm not mistaken, he actually has a slight bit of tinnitus as well. And so either it's gone away or he currently has it. I remember listening to reading someone comment about a interview that he did at a Q&A kind of session after a screening. And he was mentioning that he suffered from this. And so this is a debilitating condition that he actually had to deal with as well. And so I found that very, very curious that it's not just like, oh, you know, I was attracted to this idea of making this big car chase movie with music set to it and stuff like that. And it has even more of a personal touch to him in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah. And so, like, again, like, I feel bad, like, hearing this story yeah. and seeing this movie and then saying, man, if only at some point during those 22 years, and apparently he wrote the script like 8 years ago, I think he said on Twitter, you had like taken the time to do a second draft. Or like have a friend read it. You know, like...
Brian, come on.
Because it just...
Come on.
It's... Or like recast the roles or something, because maybe someone could do something with this, but like, you know, Ansel Elgort, his name is Baby...
I think Ansel Elgort is Ryan Gosling and Drive.
But, okay, he is Ryan Gosling and Drive.
What did you say?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
What did you say, Michael?
I'm just going to throw it out there. I think Ansel Elgort is better in this than Gosling is in Drive.
Oh, my God. That is the craziest thing you've ever said. And if you didn't live in Chicago, I would drive to your house and beat you up right now. Because
that is insane and chaotic, and no, you are making a mess of the world right now.
Right, so Ryan Drive has a stoicism that is bred by keeping his like fury and bloodlust in check, and honestly not knowing how to like interact with a person with whom he has feelings.
Yes,
Ansel Elgort has a stoicism that's bred from just kind of being a dick, like. It doesn't seem like he's trying to keep anything back. It doesn't seem like he's like wrestling with anything. He just sits there stoically because he thinks he's better than the criminals that he's with. They never really like suss that out.
Yeah.
But then when they're
no way can you interpret that?
What?
I think so.
Literally John Bernthal fucking yells at him because he thinks that too.
Yeah.
And like the entire point of the movie seems to be that, you know, he thinks that he's not a part of this world, but then he kind of realizes that he is.
But that's not really what the movie's about at all.
Oh my God,
it's literally
about spoilers. We have to get to spoilers right now because I need to point the lines that prove that you're wrong.
This is going to be fun.
This is going to be great. So anyway, but like Ryan Gosling has a barely concealed rage, and like when that guy comes up to him in the bar and he keeps his like cool, but his voice kind of breaks and he's like, if you don't leave, I'm going to knock your fucking teeth down your throat. You're like, oh, that's the guy I've been watching this entire time. When Ansel Elgort like stops being this is going to sound offensive, but I don't mean it that way. I earnestly am saying that he comes off And it is brought up in the movie that he might be, like, mildly autistic. And so when he, like, breaks into song and, like, is drumming and, like, doing a bunch of stuff and then, like, snaps back, it doesn't seem like that's the character cutting loose. It kind of seems like that's just a reprieve from this one terrible character that we have into a slightly less terrible character. His whole thing with Lily James is, like... And again, I'm not usually the one to point out problematic characters in a movie, but there will be reams of feminist writing written about Deborah in this movie. And what a shallow, listless,
you already used that word,
free character she is.
Yeah.
Did you say I can't use the word listless?
No, you already used it.
Okay, well, obviously we're hitting on a theme here. I mean, there's just so much wrong in this movie, and it goes to places that, like, seemingly betray its roots to become something else. And it's just, they're like, someone will say in one scene one thing, and then the next scene will completely contradict themselves, and you think that it means something, but it doesn't. And I just got tired of it. Like, I got tired of, like, this faux cool dialogue that I couldn't decide if the movie knew that the characters sounded like idiots, and that was the point, is that they were trying to sound cool, but they weren't making it, or if the movie actually thought they were cool. Like, when Eddie No-Nos, this is something that I saw in advertising, it's like Eddie No-Nos, and one person's like, well, what happened to your nose? And he's like, that's an Eddie No-Nos no-no. And it's like book page yeah. one or something, and I'm like, well, that's the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard. Like, that's not supposed to actually be funny, right? Or, like, interesting or cool. But it's hard to tell. Now, to the movie's credit, the car chases are fantastic. But without any connection to the characters or any insight into, like, anything that's going on, they just become, like, a Mazda commercial in the middle of this movie, because in Drive, when Ryan Gosling is trying to get away from things, or like in any movie with a good car chase, like the Bourne movies, for God's sakes, you have to want the person who's driving the car to get away, or to at least survive. And in this movie, I had no emotional connection to anyone, so all I had was this cool thing happening. And it's all homage. It's all empty, just like thoughtless, emotionless, pointless homage and recreation that is fun and might be like a cool YouTube clip to watch down the line, but like as part of a coherent story with characters that we love and a plot that we're hoping to suss out, like there's nothing there, and it was a bummer to sit through. And you know, it's just, it was, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I think what, you know, it's interesting because what you're getting at, and I'll be the first to admit we've butted heads on Scott Pilgrim and your kind of extreme feelings on it. And look, rightly so, my extreme feelings on it. I love it. You hate it. You kind of despise it. And we've kind of had our issues with that film. And I think what you're pointing out are obvious flaws that, like you mentioned, for Scott Pilgrim, people are either not going to notice or, in my case, disregard completely. I don't care that, you know, a lot of the central themes or a lot of the central romance doesn't necessarily work extremely well in that film and things like that, because I'm so enamored with all of these other aspects. This film, I don't think, has that to kind of fall back on, because like you mentioned, the car chase are so loosely peppered throughout the film that it never feels like that is a driving driving theme throughout the film. It feels like it is almost secondary. And so when you start taking away a character's primary motivations, or you don't like the character at all, you know, like for instance, in Scott Pilgrim, a lot of people don't like, I can't remember his name. I can't remember anybody's name.
He's supposed to be a terrible person, though. Like, if you read the source material, it is absolutely about how bad of a person he is.
Yeah, he is a dickhole. Like that is definitely the case. But I mean the actor himself.
Michael Cera?
Yeah, a lot of people hate Michael Cera, like, with a passion. They can't stand his screen presence at all. They don't like his shtick. And so if you're one of these people that looks at Ansel Elgort and you're just like, I really don't care about you as a character, then this film is really going to struggle. It is such an uphill climb if you can't connect to the romance at the heart of it and you can't connect to the main character at the heart of it. And then you start to notice some of these other kind of satellite things, like the potentially racist characters and how they're all caricatures and things like that. And all of a sudden, this becomes a very big slog because there just aren't enough car chases. Right.
Yeah, I guess that could also be another problem with the movie.
Yeah, I thought this movie was mainly going spoilers a little bit. No, it's not a spoiler. There are not that many car chase sequences in the first half of this film that you would expect. It's not like a rapid fire. Here's some
of car chase movies.
Sure. So it's one of those things where they are a highlight for sure. They are fantastic, but there's just maybe not enough of them to really float this film in a way. We get a lot of time with Ansel Elgort. I'll say that. How about that? Okay. We get a lot of time with his character, and I think Brian is right. I wish the times when he kind of lets loose in the car and he starts to drum to the music and he starts to lip sync to the music and he's dancing around this place, I wish more that kind of seeped into the character itself and didn't feel like it was a different character altogether, because his daily life after about a quarter of the way into this film, all of a sudden no longer reflects that kind of happiness and cheerfulness at all. And it's not necessarily has to do with what's gone on in the film. There's a sequence kind of towards the middle that starts to affect things in that way. But beyond that, it had started to falter a little bit sooner as far as character development and things like that. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you, Brian, in a lot of ways. It's tough.
It's the Scott Pilgrim problem all over again. It's just like, I agree, there's a lot wrong with this, but I don't care. It's like,
I think there's a lot of problems with this, and I fundamentally disagree with what Bill just said. I think that the whole point of his personality is, yeah. All right, you know what? Fuck it. I'll wait for spoilers.
I'm ready to go to spoilers. Like, I've eviscerated this movie as much as I can.
I'm sure you got plenty of gas.
Oh, jeez. Man, Snidell busting out the car metaphors, and my one food metaphor was pouring a glass of water into another glass of water. I don't even know if that counts as food. Someone on Twitter tell me if that counts as food.
It is sustenance. It is sustenance.
The blandness of
a watery metaphor.
Piece of American cheese on white bread. Yeah. I don't really have anything else to say.
Let's jump to spoilers.
I will say, okay, before we, like, Bill, you were talking about, like, the gunshots matching, like, the bass and the drums of the songs. Mm-hmm. That was
tequila.
Good. I enjoyed that.
Okay, so you noticed that.
I did notice that, yeah.
You noticed that because you were so pissed off at the
movie. You guys need to see Free Fire now.
I don't give a shit about anything else. And then you're like, oh, look at this.
That is literally the entirety of Free Fire.
I am down with seeing Free Fire. I still do need to see that. We're sorry that we made you watch that and never talked about it and never watched it ourselves.
I almost died in the theater. Oh, wait, that was off the podcast.
Oh my god. All right. So, yeah, let's get into spoilers. First spoiler, John Bernthal is not in this movie. Like, he it's annoying because he's in the first scene, you think he's going to be like a big bad or like a kind of like antagonistic force throughout it. But literally, by the time his name is said in the opening credits, he's gone. Like, yeah. And he'll never be back. It's... So that's sad. So what happens in this movie is you find out that Baby apparently has been boosting cars since he was, like, 13 years old. And apparently he stole a car that belonged to Kevin Spacey. And Kevin Spacey had a lot of very valuable shit in that car, apparently, but the kid dumped it somewhere and they couldn't find it. So he conscripted this 13-year-old into being his getaway driver. They've been working together for a long time so that Baby can pay off his debt. And so Baby is given what appears to be a cut of each score, but he's really only given like one bundle of bills. And Baby lives at home with his like deaf African-American foster father, whom he has a relationship with that's very sweet, but also again like tips into that. We talked about this in the last episode, like that magical Negro that like is a trope from like the Green Mile.
I don't know about that.
This guy is like, you know, oh, you're putting yourself at hazard, and Ansel Elgort's like, you know, I'd never let anything happen to you, and he's like, I'm not worried about me. And it's just like, you know, this.
It's just a cautionary guy. Like that's all he does. He doesn't actually give him any advice that goes anywhere. The one piece of advice that he gives is to be a pizza delivery guy. That goes absolutely fucking nowhere for like that's not a long term like solution to jack shit. Like all there's no magic there.
Yeah. All of these are tilts on archetypes. I would not say that any of them are racist. They're very much like knowing shifts on things that we know. Like you were talking about before spoilers about how you didn't know whether some of these characters are supposed to be dumb. They are absolutely supposed to be dumb. Like when characters, you know, from ranging from Jamie Foxx to Flea as what is his name? Henry No Name or whatever the fuck it is. No-nos. Those are absolutely supposed to be incredibly dumb characters. They're characters who are survivors, and they're characters who are good at what they do, but they're not supposed to be clever. Like, they're supposed to be something that we laugh at because of the absurdity of it.
Right, but dialogue supposed to be cool? Like...
I mean, but it's how it's presented. It's not that the dialogue is like something like, oh, I'm going to go repeat that somewhere. Like it is very much like because it's not even like there is the traditional. No one is doing the traditional tough guy thing. Even Jamie Foxx's thing here is trying very much for this middle ground between like deranged and pragmatic. Like it's not really I am not going to remotely disagree with you that there are cartoons here and that it's overly excessive and your mileage will complete. God damn it. I said it again.
Stop.
You will completely. Your opinion will completely hinge on that as well as your opinion about, you know, the titular Baby Driver. But like, I think if you start trying to say that there is something wrong with the character, I think it's way more the script than characterizations here. And I'm not going to – and I was talking to someone about this recently when I was out with people. And, you know, like Lily James' character is not good in here. It's really bad. You know, regardless whether you want to talk about it specifically in context of, you know, damseling or agency or other things like that. But – I think that Edgar Wright understands like the rituals of getting to know someone, like, and those moments obviously aren't going to work for you if you're not even in that first character. But like, I don't think it's fair to say that those things like are non-entities. Like, I think that this movie absolutely does things wrong, but like.
Well, you think I don't that know. Ansel Elgort's exactly better than Ryan Gosling in Drive. So, I mean, your opinion's invalid no matter what you say. I'm just being courteous by letting you talk. No, I know. I understand what you're saying. Like, there is... No, I understand what you're trying to say, or the idea that you're trying to put across, but, like, there is no truth or humanity to Baby and Deborah's, like, opening salvo of love, or whatever you want to call it. Like, it's, like, what is she attracted to in this...
This
bag of mayonnaise with an iPod in, like, what is? And then, like, after like one date, he says to her, like, "What are you doing tomorrow?" And she says, "You tell me." Like, that's like real, like, fucked up. Like, that's just not good. Like, that's like, this girl's literally like, any plans I have, I will fuck over in order to spend another awkward, mostly silent time with you.
Okay, let's progress the plot forward.
And then I'll just say this, at the end of the movie, after like two kisses and seeing a guy shoot someone, which I guess proves that he is alive and has like some sort of like sense of purpose in this world, she waits 5 years at least for him to get parole.
Let's progress through this movie so we can get to that point.
So he gets out of his contract, and then like the guy says, you know, we're square. But then like after like 3 days of being a pizza driver and wooing Deborah, Baby is pulled back in for another heist that goes sort... No. The heist that he gets pulled back for is the climactic one. Now, the crazy thing is that Kevin Spacey says to him, "You know I never use the same crew twice." And Baby's like, "Yeah." And Spacey's like, "But I've always used you as a driver ever since I found you. That's because you're my good luck charm." But then he walks in and sees a crew comprised solely of people with whom this man has worked before.
Yeah, but it's not the exact same crew.
But it's the... Yeah. That's...
That's literally what it means, is, are the pieces the exact same? No, they're not. So for this particular job, the crew is different. He's not using... Because most of these heist films revolve around having one set crew, because everybody's sure. fucking reliable, and then you've got that one motherfucker that's always just like tweaking out on cocaine or something, and he just can't stay above water, and he's just like, then he shoots somebody.
From Heat.
Yeah, like there's always that guy. And so that's the trope that he's kind of tweaking, is like, yes, I'm going to have these guys, but they're not all going to fit to the exact same together. So every single time they come together for this job, it's a high stress situation, and they're going to bounce off of each other. So they're not going to be settled and kind of like, "Hey, what's up, man? Good to see you, brother." Like, they're not going to do that shit, because they're going to be like, "Who the fuck are you? I don't trust you.
So
I don't
Spacey
like you."
has to find new people each time, but then he is allowed to pair them up once and never again.
I guess so.
No, yeah. because the movie, like, in each of the first two heists, the people are like, "What is up with this fucking kid, and why is he have headphones in, and why is he always listening to music, and is he even paying attention?" So you do get the feeling like, oh, okay, constantly gonna have a new bevy of interesting actors doing this. And then Kevin Spacey even kind of like says, like, "I'm always using a new crew," which explains why none of these people have already had this same conversation with this kid. Because, like, we literally have to go through it twice with people being pissed off or intrigued by this child with headphones in. Mm-hmm. And then, right after Spacey makes a point of saying, "I never use the same crew," you walk into a room that's filled with the same people. Like, and that's...
Why are we discussing this again? We just have that discussion.
Because it's poor writing. Like, it's poor writing.
No, it's not.
It sets up something that never happens. And then, so they go... And for whatever reason, like, Kevin Spacey is making these maniacs pick up their own guns, so they murder everyone. Well,
yeah, I don't understand why that's happening.
Yeah, that's a weird choice.
In a scene that is a shitty version of the sommelier scene from John Wick 2.
Yes.
Because
who is that delightful
Paul Williams?
Yeah, I've interviewed him. He's delightful.
Oh, seriously? That's awesome. Yeah.
I was about to say that we should just spend the rest of this podcast talking about that.
he's fucking delightful. There's a documentary about him, and it's great. So
in the sommelier scene in John Wick 2, it's my favorite. There are food analogies.
Did you notice the Okja reference in this film?
Oh, like it's from Everything But the Squeal?
Yes, I was like, what the fuck is going on?
That's
right
the
now?
Hot new phrase in movies is Everything But the Squeal. Because in the sommelier scene, the guy is comparing guns to wine, and he's like, "This one's a bit bolder," you know. It's like, and it makes sense because the guns that he's describing, like he's like, "This one has like a tart peakishness," and it's like a low caliber small handgun. And the one that's
and,
like,
and he
bold.
Mentions like the Italian, you know, he's referencing not only their size and what they particularly do, but their kind of country of origin and stuff like that. Just like he would do.
A bold Italian one. And he's holding up like a Bernelli tactical shotgun. And in this, the guy is just like, "I'm the butcher. Welcome to the charcuterie. You know, here's the pig, you know, the different cuts." And it's like, but they don't do anything to connect them. This guy is just an asshole. Who is like, instead of saying like, "Here's an AK-47, here's like, "Here's a round roast," and it's like, but why is that a round roast?
Yeah, what do they call grenades? It's something
sausages.
Really weird. Oh, like, what the fuck is that? What?
I don't know. Why wouldn't you call it chicklins?
I don't know.
So anyway, they kill all those people because Jamie Lee Foxx is like, they're cops. Their boxes say APD on them, which I was like, yeah, why the hell would a cop in a sting operation leave it in the box that says Atlanta Police Department?
But that's
and then Spacey's like, "Those were my cops, you idiots."
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, you should have fucking, you should have fucking told us that. Like, what is going on here? Like, that whole sequence. That whole sequence is just like complete and utter madness. Like, I was just like, what the fuck is going on with this movie? He's lost.
The other thing that happens is on their way back, they go to the diner where Deborah works, and Baby has no chill, and so it's very obvious that there's something going on between him and Deborah, and Jamie Foxx is like being an asshole, and is just gonna straight up murder Deborah, just like he murdered the guy for the gum, but Baby stops him, and then Baby's like, "Hey, I'm gonna pick you up at 2 a.m. and we're gonna go on that road trip we're talking about," and because, like, apparently she wants nothing more in this world than for a boring guy to put her in a car and start driving west. She literally basically says that. She says, like, she wants to jump in a car.
Yeah,
with,
she
like,
says boring. I believe I heard that. I heard
no
that.
No plan, no nothing, just the music. And I'm like, all right, well, you know, you have a shallow, vapid life plan. He has a shallow, vapid life. I guess you two are perfect for each other. So they go back to the room, and like we said, Kevin Spacey says, "Those were my cops." And Jamie Lee Foxx is like, "Did I say Jamie Lee Foxx?"
You did, and I wasn't gonna say anything. And then now you've said it twice now, so you're tiptoeing very much into the Jamie Lee Curtis kind of.
I am in real
making those two people into one.
What am I doing with my Friday morning, guys? This is Friday.
So Jamie Foxx says they shot first, and Spacey's like, "Is that right?" And everyone, so at this point, Darling and Buddy, played by Issa Gonzalez and John Hamm, have already decided that they're going to stab Jamie Lee Foxx. I did it again. Jamie Foxx's character to death after this thing is over. But they're like, yeah, no, the cops totally shot first. And then, Baby doesn't say nothing. And then Kevin Spacey rightly says, "This is over. We're not doing this heist." And everyone's like, "Whoa, no, we've got to." And then he's like, "Okay, Baby, should we do this heist?" And for whatever reason, Ansel Elgort's like, "Yeah, we're doing this heist." Like, if he had just said no, it would have been over. And he could have just driven and picked up Deborah and gone away.
Yeah. It is loosely veiled that basically Kevin Spacey has control of the situation, that he's going to break his legs and like murder his friends and family if he doesn't go along with this. And, you know, there is that plot twist of like, oh, he thought he was out and now he's got one final kind of thing. Maybe it's final. Maybe it's not. It's kind of vague in that way.
This is just his job now.
but literally he gives Baby an out there that just seems rock solid. Like you mentioned, if he had just simply said no, the others would have been pissed at him, but it wouldn't have been like they had any repercussion because Doc in this film is top dog, Kevin Spacey. Yeah. It doesn't seem like anybody double crosses him, especially at the end of the film. We figure out that like nobody's come after him except for the bad cops who seem mainly just pissed off that they got shot a bunch of times, which, you know, rightfully so.
Yeah.
But it's not like anybody actually comes after Kevin Spacey at any point because they feel like double crossed or they feel like they're not getting what they deserve or anything like that. So it seems like Kevin Spacey is basically for some reason untouchable in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so if he comes to Ansel in that moment and says, is it on or is it off? And Ansel says no. I think there's a very real possibility in the reality of this film that this heist doesn't go down, that Ansel is able to go drive off with his love, and this film is just peachy from that fucking point forward.
Yeah, because, you know, it's not like he has to make up a reason. You know, a maniac has murdered a bunch of cops. They were going to rob a post office. Like,
The reasoning kind of makes a little bit more sense the way they kind of explain it. But I mean, it's still a little shaky because it's not exactly cash, and you're just like, you're getting this shit. Okay, I guess. But it is if they had established that he was like burning through money for some reason, or like put the older father in a funeral or not a funeral home, a nursing home that costs a lot of money. Okay. Maybe he has to have a lot of long-term care or something like that. He's got to go through cancer chemo treatment or something like that. Right. And so Ansel is kind of burning through money. He's kind of on his last, like, okay, I don't have enough money, but it's clearly established he's got about $150,000 to $200,000 snuck away under this board in his apartment. So it's not like he has to do this heist to get more money. He's not been burning through money at all. Like, so like they could have made little small tweaks which encourage him to say yes in this moment, and instead he says no, or and instead he says yes regardless to all of these other bad situations that are kind of happening.
Right. And it's just like, and he is aware that these people are going to murder Jamie Foxx. Like, he knows.
Sure, I don't think he cares all that much about him. Like, I don't think he likes Jamie Foxx.
He has every reason to know that this is going to go wrong, and he's still like, yeah, we're doing this. And then he like, so later on, he's now that he has trapped himself in this situation rather than taking the easy out, then he decides he's going to run off. And this is when Jamie Foxx nailed it. this is when
golf
Jamie
clap,
Foxx,
Brian. Good golf clap.
I was able
for that.
To say Jamie Foxx's name correctly. So this is when Jamie Foxx, like, so John Hamm, again playing Buddy. He stops Ansel Elgort from driving away, and he's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you know, maybe you should just get out of here, because they've kind of struck up a rapport. But then Jamie Foxx comes in, and he's like, we got to talk about this motherfucking tape recorder you got, buddy. And so this is when, for like, that one thing that happened in the first 15 minutes of the movie finally comes back. And they're like, why are you recording all of our conversations? And he is like, I just like making music. Now, like, that's true. That is why he's doing it. But why would he ever think that it is a good idea to record the conversations that are taking place in an empty sweatshop?
Because he's not a smart kid. He's not smart. Like, this is what I think you're failing to understand about his character.
Everyone in this movie is an idiot? That's like, that's your defense, is that everyone in this movie is an idiot.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that, like, he continually makes bad decisions and thinks that he's invulnerable. And, like, in the moment, like, every heist, he doesn't give a fuck about the actual heist. He cares about having a soundtrack for that moment. And that is the only thing that matters to him other than Deborah. Like, this movie is, like, it's not meant, he's not supposed to be like this clever hero. And if anything, the only time he tries to make like an actual decision, which is where Kevin Spacey's character asks him whether they want to do this heist, he says yes and somehow thinks he's going to get away. I'm sorry, but I don't think that's – I mean, in general, I find it really tedious to go through – pick through each plot point. But I don't know. I did not read Ansel Elgort as, like, in any way supposed to be a clever hero, someone who, like, makes good decisions. I read him as someone who spontaneously reacts in the moment and makes the wrong decision,
but, like,
every time.
There's a difference between, like, in-the-moment reaction that ends up being the wrong choice, and should we do this heist that you clearly don't want to do, and him saying yes. Like, there's...
The only chance he really has to actually, like, make a choice... Like, what other time in that movie is he not being forced to do something? That's what I'm saying. Like, he may has bad decision making. Like, it's only through sheer skill that he survived this long.
But I feel like that in that case, the movie should lean on that skill more. It should do more with that. It should give him
the whole
something.
Movie's about it. Every scene is about that. No, but
this is what I'm talking about. This is why it's not worth it for me to talk about these movies, because, like, I can't come back against the idea that the entire point is that he's not good at anything and makes a shitty
decision.
That's
not what I said. That's not what I said.
The rest of the movie.
No, he is great at driving. He is great at what he does. That does not mean he is a smart person. Like,
you don't have to be a smart person to say no to a heist that you think is going to possibly get you killed. And you have a perfect reason not to do it.
Yeah. I don't think his decision making in this particular matter is compromised. I think he's I don't know what the fuck he's thinking, because this is a goddamn movie that's written by someone. So the writer is making the character's choices for him in this particular case. So I can't justify it beyond Edgar Wright wanted him to say yes.
Okay.
That's it. Like,
fine.
I can't fucking justify it beyond
Michael,
that, because,
like, what do you think
just
his
like,
thought
what the
process
fuck?
Was?
Like, this is such a bad, bad, bad fucking idea. Like, bad fucking idea.
Right. And so that so Michael, you said he has compromised poor decision making. So, like, what
I wasn't surprised when he made the wrong decision. That's what I'm saying, because you guys, you have talked previously. I want to specify this.
Okay.
You can nitpick the third act all you want. I think the third act is bad. I really do. But like you were talking previously about, you know, like, oh, he thinks he's better than people. Like, I really don't think any of those considerations are part of that character. I think it is very much that this person lives moment to moment and whose long-term plan is in total contradiction to how he lives his life. Like, that he would never want to... As you're saying, he thinks that he doesn't live in this world, but he absolutely does. Like, he is a bad person. Like, and as you go down this road, yeah, it definitely becomes more difficult to say, okay, why are we rooting for this person? But this was something that was there from the beginning for me. So when that later stuff happens and when he does make choices that are kind of baffling, I wasn't really that surprised. Now, from a script level, as you guys are combing through every line of dialogue, yeah, it's dumb, but it was what was necessary in that moment to get the script where it wanted to be. Yeah, essentially.
But here's the thing: like, he definitely does think that he's not a criminal and he's above these people. Because, like,
yeah, I know, but that's delusional. The movie. Okay, you want to talk about we could start pointing out moments within this movie where it continually undermines him as a hero. Like, you think of, for instance, the opening credits.
Just the way when he bumps into everyone?
Yeah. Like, he's an asshole.
Yeah, he's a dick.
Yeah.
Hold on. What? He? are we talking about the opening sequence? Because he doesn't bump into anyone in that opening.
Wait, no, I thought it was when he's getting coffee, Bill.
When he's getting coffee. I mean, that's the opening credits after the prologue.
Yeah, he.
I thought that was the second time that he started bumping into people.
No, because my God, he runs into like 14 people trying to get some coffee.
Yeah.
I know he's dodging cars. I remember that. I don't remember him actually physically bumping into people. I remember him dodging a bunch of people.
No, it's like they call him an asshole. Like he runs into like an old man, a young woman, and at least one other person.
Yeah. No, I just like I think I don't know.
No, that happened a long time ago, guys.
Sure. That's okay. Wasn't it last night for you? This is last week for me.
It was like 3 days ago for me, and I remember. Anyway,
I'm just saying, like, I don't. I think the trying to interpret his actions and even his character as like being something. What am I looking for here? It's just like I will not.
Your mileage may vary.
No, God damn it! I almost said drive though. God damn it! Okay, his existential rationale, like when you compare it to something like Ryan Gosling, like he doesn't have that like singular. Oh, I was going to say engine. Damn it. Doesn't have.
Just go with fucking. All right. He doesn't have that.
Just do it. Fine. Just put the pedal to the metal.
I'm just gonna pull this through it. Okay.
dump the fucking clutch. Come on, go.
Green light, man. Go.
He doesn't have that singular engine. What he has is him constantly being distracted by the single thing he wants to do, which is listen to music. Like, this isn't a typical heist movie because it is very much about someone who's guaranteed to fail at a certain point. Like that doesn't change where we go in the third act and how dumb it gets. I'm not going to disagree with you there, but I just think that like trying to look at this through the same lens as some heist movies that are obsessed with cool, the way this is shot is obsessed with cool, but I don't think these characters are meant to be an embodiment of that idea
So it's borrowing the aesthetic and the trappings of them, but not actually following through on them.
Yes.
Purposely.
I would agree with that. Okay. Yes.
Do you think that there's a problem with that?
I think given where the third act goes, yes, because they don't go all the way with it.
Yeah. So like this third act is like John Hamm basically becomes the Terminator. Mm-hmm. And it's over the course of perhaps 12 to 15 hours, he hunts Ansel Elgort and Lily Collins. Is that who that is? Lily James, I'm sorry.
Lily James, whatever.
Like, all around Atlanta.
I do then, like the diner scene, though. I'll say that in the third act. I like that scene.
Okay. The diner scene is the point where I really, like, threw my hands up in the air over this Deborah character.
Oh boy.
Because like she's sitting there, she's now been damseled, you know, tied to the railroad tracks.
Yes.
And then, you know, John Hamm picks up the coffee or like, you know, is like, hey, give me some more coffee. And she like they close up on her holding the coffee urn, I guess is what it's called, and pouring the coffee, and she's holding it, and I'm like waiting for the moment where that girl like takes some initiative and like dumps hot coffee on him or like pours it in his lap so that baby can get the jump on him. But instead, the only reason they've shown her holding it so much is that so that when like baby shoots the guy, her dropping the coffee urn and it shattering can match the musical cue in the background. So like the one chance they gave her for any kind of like breakout honest like initiative is really just a setup for her dropping a coffee urn. And so, you know, it's just like it's a real bummer. Like it's a real bummer of a film in that way that like he can't, and like the one woman who has like more lines and is like a stereotypical kind of like hot-blooded Latina woman.
Yes. Yeah, that's... I think you'd have a, be hard-pressed to think of a really good female character that Edgar Wright has written, to be honest. I think there are entertaining ones. I think, you know, you could point to Shaun of the Dead, you know, depending on how you feel about Ramona Flowers, which obviously we know how Brian feels. But I think that he used some real help in that department. And I do think it's a problem here. And yeah, I'm not, it is the filmmaking and the sheer momentum of this that carried me through my issues with those characters.
Yeah. And for me, like I said, like all of that, all of Wright's admittedly good filmmaking, he is obviously a skillful director.
Like, sure.
You can't take that away from him. I can't take that away from him. Like, because he just is. Like, and it's.
Yeah. He understands rhythm and editing in a way like few other people.
He really could make, like, a great kind of jukebox musical with, like, his sensibility. He just needs someone else to write the fucking script. And.
Yeah.
And, but the only other movie that's written by someone else is Scott Pilgrim, and that's the one like.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I don't know what to tell you. Like, he wrote this movie.
Yeah,
and like that's the thing. The first two movies were out and out parody homages, so like, they didn't have to really have like all their joy came from seeing inversions or like a reproduction, and this is more of the same, but it seems like it just went bad. Like, instead of like copying the great car chase heist movies of the past, he did like those 90s Tarantino knockoffs.
I don't think the Tarantino knockoff is fair at all, because I think this is very much trying to be the anti Tarantino knockoff. It's trying to point out how archetypal those things are and just try to tilt it a little bit.
It is your right as an American to think that.
All right, Brian.
So, I mean, like, I just don't agree. I just don't. I think
that's fair.
Yeah.
And as like I said, I don't really think the third act is defendable. I really don't. No, and I think this really. Movie's a B, and this is one of my favorite movies this year. So
I would say this movie is a D.
All right.
You know what's funny?
D for Drive?
Yeah, you put it in D and hit the G, the gas. I'm really upset that I said that now.
Basically, this has been a bad year. That's my point.
It has been a bad year. And, like, it's weird because, like, Kevin Spacey, he's another character in this movie that, like, really fucks up for me, because he's like, hey, you got a cute girlfriend. Let's keep her that way. I don't want to have to fucking break your legs and murder your foster father and, like, I guess throw acid in your girlfriend's face. And then after Baby has murdered someone, fucked up a heist, and, like, brought the heat to his door just because Lily James is super cute, Kevin Spacey's like, I was in love once. It's like, well, if that's the case, then why did you make this fucking mute motherfucker come and be part of your crew? Like, if you're such a romantic, why did you wait for him to show up at your doorstep with a gun and your loot and demand, like, an ultimatum and then say, you know what? Never mind. Here's money. Run to the border. You'll be fine. I'll hold off the cops, because at this point he thought they were cops that were coming to murder him. And it's just like, any, it's, what, why? Why did that happen? And, you know, like, you're talking about nitpicking, but, like, these are character inconsistencies that make it impossible for me to form any meaningful connection with these people and therefore care what happens to them.
All right, man. That is your prerogative.
My prerogative to, like, it's like, imagine if you knew a person like this in real life. Would they be your friend? Or would you try to get away from them?
No, these are bad people. How many times do I have to say this?
But you can be friends with bad people. I have a friend who's an asshole, who is the worst person I've ever met in person. But he is a friend because he is deeply predictable in certain ways. And like Begbie, I know that while he will fuck over everyone else in the room around us, he will never fuck over me. And that he has a certain moral code that if you understand it, you can be like great friends with him and have a great time. Kevin Spacey, baby, buddy, darling, fucking bats. Like, none of these people even have that much. Like, Omar in The Wire said, like, every man's got to have a code. And none of these people have a code, because that would be a drag for this movie, because they just need these people to be a fucking reactive force whenever the movie needs a little bit of gas to keep going until the next fucking car chase.
Guys, can we touch on the elephant in the room?
There's an elephant?
Yeah, there's an elephant in the room.
Yeah, you tell us what that elephant is, Bill.
In the middle of this film, there is a, I guess, overall, generally, he is a military veteran of some type, and he pulls out a fucking Uzi in the middle of his car. What the fuck is going on in this movie?
Wait, what? Okay.
The armored car heist, when, like, the military vet is just, like, coming for him.
He's got a fucking Uzi. Like, what the fuck? I understand if he's got a shotgun. I understand if he's got a couple of handguns, but this motherfucker's got an Uzi in his car.
Was it an Uzi or was it like an MP5? I can't remember.
It was definitely a submachine gun, a small submachine gun. And it was just like, what the
best part
fuck,
is,
dude?
He doesn't take it out of a case or a gun rack. I'm pretty sure he moves a T-shirt.
Yes, it's on. It's near his front seat,
now,
his passenger seat.
Bill, thank you so much for bringing this up, because no, he's just a Marine who happened to be there.
He just happened to fucking be there.
He was not a guard.
No, he's
no, like a private guard.
No, he
like,
wasn't. He was wearing a T-shirt.
Yeah, why would there be a fucking private guard in front of a fucking high, like,
he's
armored
in
vehicle?
No. He's a guy who appears to be leaving.
Yes.
So this is what I'm talking about. Like, you talked, Mike, about how, like, this is Edgar Wright coming to America again. Even though I think Scott Pilgrim takes place in Canada.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
Okay.
That entire film is a giant fucking joke on Canada.
Okay, so this is Edgar Wright coming to the continent of North America again. And
Canada.
The director of Hell or High Water, when he came to America.
Taylor Sheridan.
No, that is
the
not
writer.
The director. That is the writer.
The director is David McKenzie.
David McKenzie,
Yeah.
But David, Taylor Sheridan, to be fair, is like, I'm pretty sure he's a Texas boy, and like he's ingrained in this. So, yeah.
But look, so in Hell or High Water, like, when, and I brought it up when we were talking about the movie, I love the fact that this movie had so many quote unquote good guys with guns, because like the end of that movie is literally like an entire town in Texas takes off after these bank robbers with their private arms. Now, it's like they do the same thing in Baby Driver, but it really is like what I assume a British person thinks of America, because it's like, well, you know, if there's a guy and he's got a gun and he's going to try to stop a bank robbery, like, he wouldn't just have a handgun or a hunting rifle. Obviously, he would have an Uzi. Like, and that's just the level of what the fuckery that's happening in this movie that is distracting and ill-conceived, and I don't know. Like, I don't even know what to say. But, yeah. Bill, thanks for bringing that up, because that was funny.
Yes. Thank you.
I don't know. I really like, and then, like I said, like, you know, this vapid, pallid, shallow, listless, affectless, unaffecting, pointless, like,
I'm about
unrealistic
to mute you.
Romance that happens, and then she's like waiting for him when he gets out of prison.
I don't understand what the fuck's going on with the end of this movie, because it does the damned thing where I hate it so much. They give him consequences for his actions, but they don't give him consequences for his actions. It's the have your cake and eat it too.
Oh, he lost 5 years of his life and comes out of prison seemingly very well adjusted.
Only because
she's
helped a woman.
Yeah, and she's got a fucking gorgeous, like, you know, 1950s Cadillac or some bullshit like that. And you're just like, who? did you steal that from Bo or whatever the diner dude? Like, was that his car? Like, what the fuck is going on here? Yeah, where'd you get that vehicle?
He shouldn't have any money left.
That beat is weird wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, that, like, in a better movie, I'd be fine to accept that. But, like, just as, like, part of the dream logic. But, like, you know, it's hard to take it. And it's so weird that, like, all these people are standing up for him. And then he gets his jail time. But then he apparently gets paroled on the first opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, I think, okay, I think within the logic of the movie, which obviously we've described as flawed, you know, it's supposed to be that realization, you know, when he finally gets out of the car and he has that late chase, like, that's supposed to be a realization about, you know, how he's insulated himself and, you know, created this entirely false version of reality. Like, I think that's supposed to be the moment that is the redemption for this character.
James, like, you're not a part of this world, or like, you don't belong in this world, which is him taking ownership of the world finally that he's in.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to mention that is kind of in there. I still think that ending's terrible.
But because that's entirely undercut by this trial scene where, like, this older, you know, African-American woman is like, you know, he filled it with the car radio and then he turned around and he gave me my purse back and said that he was sorry. And, like, his African-American foster father is like, he's a good kid who got, like, pressured into a bad situation, but he's, like, a really good guy. And it's like, oh, I'm glad that we're parading the minorities back to defend this white boy who fucking shot someone and, like, was part of a heist and was driving around and being a criminal.
I don't necessarily agree with the optics there, because there is a white lady that also comes to his aid, and then there's also Lily James and stuff like that. I think that's kind of bad batching it. If I can reference another film discussion we had,
we need to end right now.
Yeah. I don't know. It's got more issues than just kind of the optics there. I think in particular. Sure. So, I don't know. This fucking movie. My friend, he asked me a question that kind of jogged my brain a little bit and I thought was interesting. And he was saying, does that finale actually even fucking happen? Does he get out of that car on the bridge, out of the Bronco on the bridge, and end up being shot there? And this is all just like made up reality, because it does happen in a very dreamlike kind of sequence. And, you know, he's already had this dream.
But isn't there an earlier
out?
Yeah.
And seeing her. Right.
But
and
like,
so
I feel like if they didn't do that,
comes back in.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I understand. Like there's a push and a pull. It's that troubling issue where the film has consequences, but it also doesn't have ultimate consequences. It's like you can kill some people, you can rob banks, and you can drive away, and you can cause all this chaos and destruction. But in 5 years, you're going to get out and you're going to come back to your sweetheart, and she's going to have a kick-ass car waiting for you. And it's just right like, now, what?
This woman who's known you for 3 days is going to wait 5 years. Oh, and she's going to write you an adorable postcard where we find out that your name is fucking Miles.
Yeah. Can we not put Route 66 on a pedestal anymore? This kid has no fucking clue what Route 66 is. He doesn't have an idea. By the way, I found it really fucking interesting. I found it really interesting that they make this film look like the 80s when he's having flashbacks, but he's clearly got a Generation 1 iPod. And I was like, what the fuck is going on with like the visuals in this film? Because it looks like it's the 80s. He's got an iPod
that
generation
was like 19. Wasn't that the, didn't that come out 9/11?
I think it came out the day of
9/11.
I was in fucking high school when the iPod came out. Like what the fuck is going on in this movie?
The first iPod was indeed released in 2001.
Yeah. On 9/11?
I don't know. I'm looking it up, but my computer's being very slow.
But yeah, so I was just like, what the fuck? Like, man, that is a nostalgia trip where I'm just looking at everything else around them, like the way she's dressed and all that. I'm like, that is not 2001. Like,
at least he doesn't have a Zune.
Michael, it was October 23rd, 2001.
All right, ignore me.
Already working on it. Dang, I feel like I had something else to say, and now I can't for the life of me remember what it was. But it had to do with all that bullshit. I will say this. So, like, you know, this might be how I wrap up. unless I remember the other thing I was going to say, because I feel like it was really cool, and I'm super sad.
I doubt it.
I can't remember what it was. But, so, like, you know how, like, someone will come along and people will call him, like, the next Spielberg, you know? But, like, sure. What I was thinking about is...
Are we talking about Colin Trevorrow?
Yeah, so, like...
Bong Joon-ho is the latest.
But the problem is that, like, you know, when Spielberg became the Spielberg, no one else was doing Spielberg. He became that by doing an original new thing.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so whenever we slap that label on someone who's just trying to redo Spielberg, you're not saying he's the next Spielberg. You're saying he is a Spielberg wannabe, which is not the same thing. Like, the next Babe Ruth won't be, mm-hmm. like, Babe Ruth exactly. He won't stand the sure. same way. He won't look the same way. He will just be a guy who is great at the game of baseball.
Well, I think
so. You should choose someone who has an original vision and is doing something and legitimizing a genre or a type of film that you never expected to be legitimized. And that should be your new Spielberg. Not someone who shoots people slightly upwards, staring into the sky, like, with their eyes open. And I think the problem
Who said
is,
this is Spielberg?
No, and I'm getting to that. I think the problem is that we have learned to love certain things so hard that we will reward people for giving us more of that rather than trying to encourage them to be actually original. And so I feel like that's what we're coming to with Edgar Wright. Like, I feel like he is so skilled at giving us facsimiles and remixes of things that we love without ever really truly saying anything original or new of his own. And that's what he has to do to really break out of this. Because otherwise, he's going to have a rabid fan base, and he's going to be successful to some degree, and even if just in a cult status. But he's never really going to do anything more interesting than what he's already done. Which, again, is just a skillful, interesting remix of material that we've already seen. And that's becoming a problem all around the world, as evidenced by, like, people calling everyone the new Spielberg just because they evince E.T.-like or you know, Jurassic Parkian motifs. Like,
no, but I think... I gotta say something about that Spielberg thing. There are obviously, you know, hacks who say that, like, someone evinces Spielberg or Amblin, you know, in this very, like, 80s sense. But I think you can also say as much that someone could be a new Spielberg in just as you're saying, like, in being able to show such a diversity of abilities and just a sense of an identity that could go in so many different places. Like, I think that's, you know, I think with things like Stranger Things or whatever, it became easy to say things like, you know, Amblin, but I think when people, you know, point to a director who isn't just working with kids and say that's the new Spielberg, they're talking about, like, possibility as much as, like, a specific tone or sensibility.
Okay. Bill, any thoughts on this sort of wrap up that we've decided to do?
No.
Okay. Good times. I can't remember the other thing that I was going to say, which is bumming me out.
I'll mention one final thing, since you can't remember your one final thing. No. This film is very analog heavy, obviously. I found it interesting that there's a couple of notes, if you're kind of geeky like me, that you noticed. All of his iPods are the old scroll style
click
kind
wheel.
Of iPods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, click wheels. They do not. He didn't have, like, a full screen iPhone kind of version of it. And I found that interesting personally. Those were the iPods that I loved. I loved the tactile kind of feedback of those. The second thing I will notice is related to that, and the opening sequence heavily features him using a manual transmission. And this is is one of those things that I notice because I drive a car that has a stick shift. I'm obsessed with stick shift. I love this. And it is interesting that from that sequence on, even though the truck, I understand most trucks are just going to be automatics. And, you know, it's weird to have a stick in a truck unless it's some kind of souped up version of one. But he does drive like a couple of other vehicles that are very noticeably not stick and are available in stick, whether it's the Challenger or, you know, even like the old Bronco, I don't think is necessarily stick because there would have been an awkward sequence probably where he had to teach Lily James how to drive a stick because not because she's a female, but because she very obviously doesn't seem to actually have a car or any kind of wheels of her own. I don't think I don't know. She's not very car.
She gets that beautiful 1950s Cadillac.
Sure. So I guess she's had 5 years to practice on a stick, more than likely. But so, you know, I found it interesting that it kind of fetishizes his stick shift movements in the middle of the or at the beginning of the film, as it kind of rightfully should. Like, you know, a lot of these. You know, it's a beautiful thing to kind of watch people shift and run through the gears. And from that point on, there's no more sequences where he actually has to shift gears. And yeah. I found it weird that all of this stuff has all of this analog stuff, analog, whether it's the tapes, whether it's the iPods, which even now he could have had a modern version of an iPod. He has the old click wheel style. He has a hard drive. It's not flash drive based. You know, all of these other things just keep adding on. And yet the vehicles that he ends up with towards the end are not manual transmission. And I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, come on, man. Like, you're going to reference Bullet. You're going to reference Driver. You're going to reference all of these films that, you know, you can hear them shifting gears. You can hear the transmission catch and all of these great sounds that these vehicles emit. You get the
close-up of their feet moving in that very balletic kind of way.
Like I love that shit. And this film gives it to me for about 5 minutes and then it's like, fuck your dreams, Bill. Fuck your dreams. And it's just like, damn it, man. Come on. So I just had to wrap that up and mention that. So yeah. That's the thing I noticed.
All right.
And that's the last word. Yeah, that's fuck your dreams.
I'm going to listen back to this podcast and I am going to remember exactly what it was I wanted to talk about. And I'm going to be pissed. I just know it's going to happen. It's going to happen. I'm going to be so angry. But that doesn't matter. What does matter is that some person is trying to call me on Skype and I keep hanging up on them and they have literally, this is now 6 times I'm hanging up again. Let's see if it happens again.
So popular.
Oh my God. I don't know who this is. I half want to answer this call just on the podcast. Let's just
answer on air.
Just give me 1 second, guys. Brian Rowan. Hello? Hello?
It's been fun.
That's bananas. I answer and no one says anything. But they've stopped calling, so that's all that's important.
That's because they're in the house.
No, that is true. They're probably in the house. So that's it for today for this. Baby Driver, it's out in wide release now. I hated it. Bill and Michael seemed to not hate it as much as me in varying degrees. Michael says it's the most fun you can have in a theater right now.
Since Fury Road.
It's a B, though, and he has a lot of problems with the third act.
Yeah.
All right. This is close to like a positive opinion as we've gotten from you in a while. I'm telling you,
I would say you actually like this movie.
I liked the lore. I liked what else is recent?
Wonder Woman.
Yeah, Wonder Woman is fine.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Okay. I'm just going to say this, though. If we don't see a movie that like I love very soon, I'm going to blow my fucking brains out.
Same.
So The Beguiled and A Ghost Story have, like, are like the things that are going to save my life if they're good. If not, I'm just going to give up and I'm going to die. Anyway, we are brought to you by Mubi, MUBI.com, the curated online streaming cinema where you can see some of the best films from all around the globe, including right here. Last week we talked about the fact that The Wicker Man is on Mubi. It is still there because it has not been 30 days yet, and you got to see this. It's the original Wicker Man with Christopher Lee and Britt Eklund, and it is amazing. Speaking about movies that are like stealth musicals, just like Baby Driver, that's pretty much what The Wicker Man is. It's a lot of pagan chanting and dancing and nudity and weirdness.
That's my jam, pagan chanting.
You gotta check it out. It's a great fucking movie, and it is on Mubi now. So for your free 30-day trial of Mubi, which is worth it just to see the original Wicker Man, go to MUBI.com/filmstage for a free 30-day trial on us so that you can understand the wonder that is Mubi. Also, don't forget that if you would like to win Tampopo on Blu-ray, which we stole from Jordan Raup after feeding him an entire turkey so that he passed
out. Maybe he's trying to call you.
That would be hilarious. Guys, please stop. No, we
still tied up
Slack all the time. He's obviously not having the best time, but he's still very much okay with it. Insofar as he's not willing to tell us to stop because, you know, he's too polite. He can tell we're having fun.
He really cares about that for that Patreon.
Yeah. So, and he has offered to just send me these DVDs and Blu-rays, but I'm like, no, Jordan, you know what? I need to go. I need to break into your apartment. I need to drive a 8-hour round trip from DC to New York every week.
I really hope I'm not going to have to testify about this, you know, because we now have like on podcast evidence for multiple episodes of us, you know, committing assaults and
freedom of speech, baby. I can't be tried for speaking my words. Anyway, so Tampopo on Blu-ray Criterion Edition. All you've got to do is become a patron. Go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow to see what we're trying to do. If we reach $50 an episode, we will start doing classic movie podcast. And to that end, in the next week or so, we're going to try to record our first classic movie podcast, and it will be on Eraserhead.
Woo!
That is first of all, the person who put us over for the month, he requested it, and so we gave it to him. But also, it's a perfect time for Eraserhead now that the new Showtime Twin Peaks is happening. And if you are interested in Twin Peaks, if you're watching that, then you should check out The Dark Moods Woods, which is another podcast by The Film Stage. It has Nick Newman on it, and it is all about the new Twin Peaks. So check that out. Again, that's patreon.com/thefilmstageshow, and become a patron. Help us out, guys. You can be part of the Slack, where we talk about all manner of madness and answer your burning questions. But that's it for today. So, gentlemen, let's tell the fine people where we can be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
You can find me driving my manual vehicle on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on Filmstage and FreshFiction.tv, but mainly hanging out in the Slack channel that we have for our Patreon members, because I love that shit.
Yeah. Michael Snydell.
You can find me ignoring other people because my headphones are too loud on Twitter at Snydell. And I write things for Filmstage, where I'll have a pretty cool interview sometime soon. So look out for that, and I'll say when it's up.
All right. And you can find me creating more Malick Busters on Twitter. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to my Twitter at Brian J. Rowan and check out the last couple's days worth of posts.
It is the most Brian J. Rowan thing on possible.
Yeah, if you like me, you will love Malick Busters. And people have been requesting more, so this is a thing that I'm just going to keep doing until it slowly becomes my thing. So, Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, my personal site dearfilm.net, and thefilmstage.com. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Tune in not even next week, like in 3 to 4 days, when we will be reviewing The Beguiled by Sofia Coppola.